is because of Robert Norris rather than because of his own
failure
lack
to do
of
anything.
Capability.
Failure to do anything
speak
about
up
it.
For what's right.
Well, yeah, he took the same position about a year and a half ago when we interviewed him, the homeless working group. Michael Schmidt and I were working on a homeless group together. As I said, Schmidt has been a homeless activist and put as much energy into the homeless activist scene, I would say. Well, that's not entirely true. He's put a lot of energy into his campaign, to my dismay, to some extent, because I don't think, as I said before, that these political campaigns are as important as grassroots organizing efforts on issues. But the amount of time he put in on the homeless issue was quite impressive, like 4 or 5 hours, maybe even 10 hours a week. And Premack was one of the candidates we interviewed back in the fall of 2000 when there were a bunch of them running for the city council. And Premack had the same story, which is that I and those who believe in raising the issue of homeless civil rights and castigating the city's anti-homeless 11 to 8:30 a.m. sleeping ban, prohibition on sleeping anywhere on public property, and now you can't sleep on private property either, except 3 days a week, except for church property in a vehicle, in three vehicles.
Is that 3 days a week or 3 days a month?
I'm sorry, quite right, 3 days a month, and thanks for that correction. So his theory then was if we'd only kept our mouths shut about all this, the community would have come to know and love the homeless, and it wouldn't even be an issue. People could camp and sleep where they needed to, and there would be no sleeping ban or no larger camping ban, which I thought was a very interesting position. It's the first I'd ever heard it put that way. It isn't the old Rotkin position of, oh, we're a very humane community, the police elsewhere just bust people on the heads and drive them out of town, but we give them sleeping bans that they have to follow, and therefore they're more humane. That's the Rotkin position, former council member, current UCSC instructor Rotkin, or lecturer, I guess he is. So it's an interesting position, or you might have the Mayor Crone position, which is sleeping is a human right, but I don't dare bring it up to try to change the law so that people sleeping could actually be a human right, because I don't want to waste my political capital, I don't have the votes, I don't want to offend the voters, and I don't want to go to any meetings.
Well, that sounds like exactly what Mark said.
Uh-huh.
You know, why should Mark jeopardize people's love of him, you know, by speaking up on something important?
Well, I think this Premack has actually for a long time been, you know, pretty consistent on this position, which is that he thinks I and others like me, Jane Immler, Linda Edwards, Dan Hopkins, I don't know, he doesn't name names, but he names my name, but he says that, you know, the activists, the ones who've raised the issue, have, you know, antagonized and polarized the community. And that's sort of like blaming Martin Luther King for the KKK. I mean, I don't know if that's the appropriate way to go. And I don't want to compare myself to Martin Luther King in that way, because I'm not risking my life, generally speaking, I would say. So I don't, you know, it doesn't really rise to that level. I'm not that kind of a national figure. I don't want to be. But locally, I don't think he's accurate. I think that the sleeping ban was put into place by the police department, working through the city council after the Scott Creek Bluff case essentially showed that the community was not going to convict homeless people for sleeping in their vehicles. And as a consequence, and in order to facilitate this, facilitate police enforcement of anti-homeless perspective, which was the police policy throughout the 70s. In 1978, they passed the sleeping ban sections of the larger camping ordinance, which for the first time made it criminal to sleep anywhere on public property and on most private property. And ironically, our city council last Tuesday made it even worse. So, I mean, we are in a very strange situation in Santa Cruz, and Premack, of course, is doing nothing to help it.
Well, with regard to that last phone call, or with that interview that you were playing,
mm-hmm.
the guy in Santa Monica was. Do you think cases like his are ever won?
Oh yeah. In fact, in another section of that interview, which I'll probably be playing either if I have enough time today, but more likely on Thursday or next week at this time, he talks about the case of Edward Larson, who. He was a guy with dreads in the Los Angeles area who used to go out and walk at night, and police kept stopping him and demanding ID, and he refused to give it, saying, you know who I am, you don't need my ID. And eventually the case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it was in 82 or 83, Edward Larson, Lawson, his name is, L-A-W-S-O-N, and they threw out all the loitering laws nationwide. There is no... It is unconstitutional to have a loitering law in the United States of America because of his determination And I think that, you know, it's important. I mean, I'll credit myself with helping to that Food Not Bombs to feed people in San Francisco, because I went to jail in 1996. I was the only one convicted of violating their restraining order against Food Not Bombs, that they couldn't serve food anywhere in the city and county of San Francisco. I went to jail for a month, and every day I was in jail, they fed food on the steps of the jail. They said they fed breakfast every morning, and the police didn't dare go after them, and they stopped harassing Food Not Bombs for 3 years as a consequence. So I think the people willing to take a stand do have an impact. Sandra Loringer here in Santa Cruz was an antique dealer who fed people free food on the town clock steps in 1989, along with myself, Jane Immler, Linda Lemaster, and others. And we had an impact. They took many of us to court. They convicted Sandra Loringer. She was in jail for 2.5 weeks. She said to the judge, when he said, "Well, I'll let you go if you'll just take probation and promise not to do this again." She said, "I'm going to be giving out sandwiches anyway, Your Honor. I think I am beyond rehabilitation." And they put that on our T-shirt. So, yeah, I think that those cases can be won.
You know, I was reading the letters to the editor in the Sentinel, I believe it was Thursday, and there was a very anti-homeless letter in there saying that she had never, you know, why compare, you know, what the city council is doing to Nazism or anything like that, and that's extreme. And she's never heard of anybody being denied service. She's never heard of homeless people being murdered and, you know, all kinds of stuff. It just blew me away. Like,
let me read that letter aloud. I've got it right here. "Why is it when someone suggests that homeless people, particularly the homeless by choice or houseless by choice, exchange work for services, someone inevitably screams Nazi? Is it possible to be that ignorant about the realities of Nazi Germany? I've yet to hear anyone suggest the homeless, even career homeless, be denied access to public facilities, forcibly relocated, incarcerated, enslaved, or eliminated. Why is it unreasonable to suggest that those who are capable and who aren't already working in some other capacity be willing to help keep homeless services available to all who need them?" Well, the key issue here has been, and the guy, she's referring to a letter and a speech at City Council by an activist named Scott Rhodes, who's a friend of activist Jerry Henry, who is fighting one of those legal cases we're talking about for being barred from the Aptos Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center for advising young people of their civil rights. But Rhodes' letter and his statement essentially talked about this proposal before City Council, which was a very minor and very heavily restricted liberalization of the Sleep in the Parks law, which would allow well-subsidized, well-funded, well-politically connected groups, or one group. In the past, it's been the AIDS walk and the dog show. It would allow the Parks and Rec director, Jim Lang, to suspend the ordinance, to allow for an additional 2 weeks only in one of three parks for a group engaging in conservation restoration activity, such as Camp Paradise, for example, was doing before it was washed away. And such as it still does under the auspices of the Santa Cruz Service Corps. And this was actually passed unanimously by City Council. Premack did a kind of a double flip-flop on this issue. First he introduced it, then he opposed it, and then he came back and supported it, which I'll be talking about later in the show. But Rhodes stood up, Scott Rhodes, and said, "Look, there's a sleeping ban in Santa Cruz," at which point he was immediately ruled out of order by, Keith Sugar objected, and I think Crone, the mayor, who was presiding, said, "You've got to talk on the subject. That's not relevant." And of course, it was relevant. They were talking about amendments to the camping ordinance that impacted the right of people to sleep. So certainly the sleeping ban was relevant. And finally, he was allowed to continue. And what Rhodes said was, if it's illegal for people to sleep anywhere and everywhere in Santa Cruz unless they do work, then this is a form of slave labor, because you have to sleep. It's not like, you know, you can get some additional funding if you do some work, and isn't it a good idea to help homeless services by working? Yeah, sure. But if you're forced to do it, or you're a criminal and you're going to be fined and put in jail and harassed at midnight, yes, that is a form of slave labor. And that's something the writer of this letter, Audrey Nickel, that we just read, doesn't seem to understand. And also that I think Mayor Crone and his cronies had some trouble. If they understood it, maybe they understood it, but they certainly weren't going to talk about it.
Audrey Nickel.
Audrey Nickel was the name of the letter writer who wrote this letter to the Sentinel, which was in the Friday Sentinel.
N-I-C-H-O-L.
N-I-C-K-E-L,
oh, okay.
From Mount Hermon. And she writes some other things. She says, you know, she has not heard that the BB denied access to public facilities. Well, they
open your eyes.
Yeah, they are denied access to public facilities insofar as there is, of course, this is the basis of some of the protests I've been doing downtown around the Boycott Sushi Now, Boycott Alibaba's Cafe campaign, Boycott New Leaf Market, that by turning the entire or much of the mall, well, let me put it this way. Much of the mall is becoming private in the sense you see these barriers going up and the sidewalk cafes taking over areas of public space. But more important, you see police differentially citing and ticketing depending on the concerns of merchants. And if people who are dressed one way get hassled, and people who are in another economic category do not. And it's not, you know, 100%. I mean, there are exceptions, and there's, you know, nice cops, and there's mellow periods. But there's sufficient amount of that kind of what I call economic profiling, in which, by the way, is supposed to be coming up for discussion at the next Citizens Police Rah-Rah Board meeting, Citizens Police Review Board, for those who have like the actual name, which is next Monday, a week from tomorrow, in the Beach Flats, for those who want to go to that meeting. People might or might not be interested, and I'll be talking about it next week. But there is that kind of economic profiling going on, so that this woman, I think, is, she takes a different view of this position than I do. She says further, it's the responsibility of any civilized, compassionate society to provide for those members who can't provide for themselves, which Santa Cruz doesn't do. I mean, it's not like...
Yeah, and what does she do?
I don't know. She actually might be a very charitable person who has a misimpression that all these services are available when they're not. There is 10% of, only 10% of the homeless population has access to a place on the floor to sleep legally without the threat of a $54 ticket, a bust, confiscation of property, you know, and all the abuse that goes with, and all just, not just, not even abuse. If you get arrested at night, you don't get to go to work the next day. If you get ticketed and woken up in the middle of the night, you're not likely to be as good a worker the next day either. So all these things have implications that I don't think she is too aware of, you know.
And recently, I cut out an article from a paper about how important it is to sleep at night.
Yeah.
You know.
Sure. I mean, sleeping is a need, and then that was found by the ICORN decision of the state Supreme Court, which, you know, they're kissing the ass of the upper class by saying that, okay, you know, camping laws are legal because there might be some rich camper who they would apply to who doesn't need to camp. But if you can show there's a necessity to sleep or camp, particularly to sleep, then that will eliminate any conviction, and that's what was found in the... In the case in Santa Barbara, the Riley and Cooper cases that I've kind of followed on this show and read about, these were activists, or not activists, they're just ordinary individuals who were living in their vehicles, who the police said, oh, you can go to the mission shelter, leave your pets and your vehicle behind and go to this shelter, you'll be broken up and forced to listen to religious, you know, propaganda, but that's life. Well, they said, no, you know, we're in our vehicle, unless there's some other alternative you can offer, you cannot, you know, we have a need to sleep. And we don't have a need to sleep necessarily right here, but where? And he didn't have any other, you know, there were no reasonable alternatives. And the same was true with Camp Paradise, although the court decision went against Camp Paradise because we have a local politically compliant commissioner called Irwin Joseph, as most of them are, who found against Camp Paradise, even though he didn't have any reasonable alternatives for them. But as you say, sleeping is not an option. It's a need.
And it shouldn't be some kind of privilege that people have to earn. It shouldn't be like you work for your sleep.
Right.
It's just a right.
Well, I mean, it's true that, I mean, you're going to hear the argument, this is the most beautiful place, you know, on the coast, and costs a lot of money to live here, so where people suggest we have to come and they provide free sleeping places for anybody who wants to come here. And the answer to that is, it's a complex one, but the basic answer is, it's not such a wonderful thing to be able to sleep on the street or in your vehicle.
Right.
I mean, it happens, and people do come here, and they do that, and there are problems that can develop, but those problems can be addressed directly rather than by criminalizing in a broad way.
And Premack was worried about the magnet effect, the so-called magnet effect.
Well, that is one of those myths that Rotkin likes to rail about, even though he denies there's a magnet effect for social services. He says you can provide wonderful social services, and it won't provide a magnet effect, but if you allow people to sleep in their vehicles or outside, then everyone will come here. This, of course, belies the experience, or if you establish a campground, everyone will come here. Those are his claims, but he doesn't give you any evidence. And his His fellow council member, Sugar, kept asking for evidence back in 1999 when they were considering changes in the law, minor changes, but Sugar was looking for bigger changes to his credit in those days. And Rotkin had nothing to say that would show, that would answer Sugar's concerns. He doesn't mind giving a long speech against me when I have no right to reply at city council. And if I stand up and try to reply, I'll be found out of order, even arrested, if I try to make a ask for time to respond. But he won't get into debate with Sugar about it because Sugar was on the subcommittee that found there was no magnet effect, that in Miami, Florida, when safe sleeping zones were opened, that there was no increase in the use of social services. There was no increase in the number of people who came to town. And that the reason things increase are because of a huge opening up of jobs or because people are being driven away forcibly from nearby areas. Those are the reasons why you get an increase of homeless people in a population, or of course a bunch of people getting laid off, as has been happening here recently.
Right.
You know, with Lipton's tea and so forth. We're talking, by the way, with who are we talking with there?
Steve Weiss.
And what group are you with?
Huff UCSC and the CalPERG Hunger and Homelessness Project.
And your next meeting, you were saying, is Wednesday at 6 o'clock on the second floor of the Student Center in the evening?
And anybody out there can reach me at 427-0270.
427-0270 to reach Steve. Anything else you want to say, Steve?
No, just looking forward to the rest of the show.
Hey, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot.
All righty.
Bye.
Well, those lines are open again at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is your opportunity to jump on board, 427-3772. So do it, and you get your chance to be heard on the air. I'm a longtime subscriber to High Times magazine, which is kind of a glitzy, cheesy magazine in many ways, but it also has some interesting updates on the struggle against the drug war. I'm going to read one of their articles. Their articles are a little bit out of date because the magazine does come out, you know, 2 months ahead or behind, but there's some interesting stuff. Here's an article, The Medical Marijuana Vote, New Initiatives Are on the Horizon. Santa Monica, California. Americans for Medical Rights, the Drug Law Reform Organization, which has introduced successful medical marijuana measures in 8 states, is planning to launch a new ballot initiative in 2002 in which voters would authorize their state governments to distribute medicinal cannabis. The initiative would run in either Oregon, Washington, or Arizona in November, with Oregon the strongest possibility. California was ruled out because it would require too great resources, says AMR spokesperson Gina Palancar. We've been trying to figure out how to respond to the recent actions of the federal government, which is working through Attorney General John Ashcroft to thwart the will of the voters, Palancar explains. With this initiative, we want to bring the issue of distribution back to the voters. She cited the October 2001 DEA bust of the Los Angeles Cannabis Resource Center as a major impetus for moving to put the initiative on the ballot. It came at a strange time nationally. We have all these security issues, but resources are being used against medical marijuana patients. Indeed, a poll cited by the California Medical Association revealed approximately 75% of all Americans support medical marijuana, a much higher proportion of the populace than voted for President Bush. The initiative, Palancar explains, would require the state to first petition the federal government for a legal source of medical marijuana, perhaps cultivated on the Fed's pot farm in Mississippi. If that request is denied, the state can then operate their own medical marijuana farm on state land. The initiative would not permit interstate distribution in order to avoid conflict with federal laws requiring interstate commerce, or regulating interstate commerce, sorry. However, legally implementing a state-run medical cannabis distribution system is not the primary goal of the planned initiative. AMR is eager to test whether the federal courts have the power to overrule states' rights in regard to medical marijuana. There's no turning back on this issue. We welcome federal conflict, Palancar elaborates. Will the feds have the courage to file an injunction against a state or state official? We don't think the feds would fight state rights. Palancar says a favorable ruling by the Supreme Court could open the door to every state being legally able to provide medical marijuana. However, the Supreme Court in May 2001 ruled 8-0 against the medical necessity defense for providers, holding that marijuana has no recognized valid medical use because Congress has said so. The federal government remains adamantly opposed to medical marijuana. Personally, my heart goes out to those who are sick, but I don't believe marijuana is the answer, DEA spokesperson Richard Meyer told the LA Times.
I believe it's more harmful than beneficial. He reiterated that his agents are required to enforce all drug laws. This is from High Times, the April 2002 issue, Mark Miller. And here's another story, No Compassion. And by the way, we had a caller that called in. If you want to call back, please do. I was in the middle of reading the story, so I wanted to finish it. But hey, be happy to take your call now if you want to get back to me during this key interval. So again, Free Radio Santa Cruz, 427-3772 is our number. And looks like a couple of ads here, I should say a couple of notices, PSAs. Here's a feminist say basta to U.S. foreign policy. Celebrate International Women's Day and the militant working women throughout the world who are leading the fight for peace, justice, and human rights. This is up in San Francisco. March 10th, 2 p.m., sumptuous international buffet at 5. $2 donation for the door, $8.50 for the buffet. New Valencia Hall, 1908 Mission Street, San Francisco. And that's up there rather than down here. So here's a story called No Compassion. Oh, wait. Here's a phone call first. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hello. Robert.
Yes.
How you doing?
I'm good. You're on the air.
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, good.
I wanted to ask you regarding the issue of the hippie, what you call a hippie planter.
Yuppie planter, please.
Yuppie planter.
It was hippie planter, but it's no longer hippie planter. You have to pay money to sit there.
In regards to people being respective of others' space and peace.
Right.
How do you see that?
Well, I think that everyone has a right to have their peace and space respected, and the point that has been made by those who favor the privatization of the area is that there have been numerous incidents that have happened there, that there is a large, regular crowd that gathers there, and that some of those individuals have been disrespectful of people. Some of them smoke, for example, even though there isn't any law against smoking. It does disturb the patrons of the sidewalk cafes, and I frankly am a non-smoker. I don't like smoke blown in my face. They've concerns have ranged from abusive or, what do you call it, sexually harassing comments toward women, hey baby, that sort of thing, which frankly when I was there I didn't hear too much of, but I'm not as sensitive to it. I'm, you know, a chunky older man, and you know, I guess people aren't doing that to me so much.
Well, I think the issue might be what is reasonable, and these things are very difficult to define.
Yeah.
And hence, when we cannot define them agreeably, we move towards the privatization, as you used,
mm-hmm.
As a way to delineate
right.
the issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think that culturally. We're seeing a rise of in-your-facism and belligerentism.
Hmm.
I think that the high note of the, let's just say the late 70s, when the...
Hello? Hello, Bob? Hello? I think we lost you there. Call right back and we will attempt to get you again. Give us a call. In regard to what the caller was saying, I think you do need to have standards of respect. And, you know, on the other hand, as social pressures increase, you are going to have in-your-face situations necessarily happening as people are sort of jostled together. I mean, that does happen as well. I had proposed a code of conduct. I don't know if I sent this out to Bob. Anybody wants to hear to see this code of conduct that was proposed? And again, it was just a rough drafts based on suggestions by Matisse Selman, owner of Sushi Now, to some extent conversations with Ali Cobb, Alibaba's Cafe, and also with some of the kids or youth, young people who hang out at the planter or did before it became Yuppie Planter. And as I say, the preserve of those who have the money or the friends or are the friends of Ali and Matisse. And this, it was sort of a long series of proposed suggestions about, you know, respect, don't blow your smoke over here, set up a corridor where you play hacky sack over there, understand that if you're going to use a table, ask before you, permission before using a table, realize that the tables are for customers, a whole series of, you know, I guess in a way relatively elementary things, but, you know, things which the store owners had felt were not being properly addressed. And instead of dealing with these proposed guidelines and getting together with the kids and holding, let's say, a couple of meetings even, Ali and Matisse, although they made some individual efforts to talk to the kids there, went straight to the downtown association, the redevelopment agency, and the city council, and had the thing privatized. I mean, this, to some extent, of course, was part of the downtown association's plan to, you know, have the uniform throw your money in the door standards as you walk downtown. As I put it, that's an exaggeration, of course, but there has been... The Downtown Association has historically, and I don't think it's changed, been hostile to counterculture people downtown and hostile to homeless people being down there. They set up the downtown ordinances, the hosts, a whole series of regulatory, discriminatory agencies, in my mind, that, not just my mind, I think in fact, but it is my opinion, certainly, that... I show the increased gentrification of the area, and that's really the direction they're going in. It's they're trying to turn it into a sort of a Carmel-like scene or a Capitola Mall-type scene. I mean, not quite that far, but, you know, in that direction. And it's not something I want to see happen. I mean, the entire rebuilding of the mall after the earthquake, as I've said many a time, destroyed... the foliage, destroyed the red brick planters, destroyed the ambling kind of quality of the mall, and it was done at largely at the behest of political bureaucrats, like Marty Wormhout, by the way, who championed this whole idea of defoliate the mall, and then police chief Jack Bassett. We have another call, or perhaps the same caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
I hope I'm better this time.
You're always good, Bob.
Rudeness is the idea, Robert.
Well, fuck you. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead, caller. Yes, rudeness, please.
Rudeness.
Yes.
Which is difficult to define.
Yes.
I'm not claiming to be an expert on it, but certain issues like reasonableness come in here.
Yeah.
But what happens, in my opinion, as I was alluding to before, in my opinion, mm-hmm. in the late 70s, there seemed to me to be a movement towards things like decriminalization of drugs, things like solar tax credits, a humanization, if you will.
Mm.
But I think that
rent control.
We have seen the exact opposite appear, or near the opposite, which is a culture of rudeness and in-your-face-ism and bullyism and terrorism.
Well, we have...
And people have limitations on how much bullyism... and terrorism, they're willing to consider to be reasonable.
Now, wait a minute.
How they react.
Our commander...
And I will use that corner as an example, Robert, of the state of affairs in Santa Cruz 2002.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I think that I'm going to talk about that, but I find, you know, that what you get is... what we have, for example, nationally with the Patriot Act and the endless state of emergency and the secret government and the huge... $40 billion being sent to, are they tracking down, Osama bin Laden? Or are they just, you know, gearing up for more foreign expeditions elsewhere? They're not rude. They're very polite to you at the airport as they take away your civil rights. You know, to me, in a way, the in-your-face response is really a response to a kind of a militarization or... well, you want to call it gentrification. You know, you yourself have talked about in the past the kind of the two levels that have been developing, where you have a level of poor, almost wage slave labor that gets, you know...
We've been heading toward the security state long before 9/11.
Right, definitely.
And the reason why, in my opinion, is that people don't want to know. They prefer to look the other way,
right.
Unless it involves their self-interest, their property values, their own neighborhood, if they can extend their property values that far. Otherwise, people don't want to know, Robert.
Right. Well, it's
hence we have this whole rise of lawyerisms, and it's not necessarily bad to fine tune the law and all that. But this tendency towards not becoming involved on any community basis, other than to score some property points, is where we're at.
Right.
And once again, to me, as I look back at the attempt. the post-60s attempt towards socialization, if you will. People became afraid of it. They couldn't figure out what their identity was to be. And we tend to glorify rudeness, bullyism, and terrorism. But let me toss this in there as one of them imperfections of life. In my opinion, we, the United States of America, has to attempt as best as it can to function as a military presence.
Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to open that one. But
Osama bin Laden is the classic bully terrorist, Robert.
Well, I would say that the U.S. government has bullied and terrorized more people than Osama bin Laden has even met in his life. But that's just, you know, I think that's sort of elementary history.
But, I'm not trying to claim American perfection historically, but the necessity for controlling territory by force and attempting to implement law is quite clear and based upon all of human history.
Well, again, let's
anarchy is folly.
Let's go back to
what it degenerates into is bullyism and terrorism.
Well, let me get back to what as I said, there's a different. My perspective is somewhat different. It is that the reason you have the reason rudeness arrives is because, I mean, there are many reasons, but I'm wondering if the current reason we have the rudeness we do, to some extent, has to do with a reaction to a military kind of culture or a reaction to a gentrification slave labor kind of culture, where, as you've pointed out yourself, you can't rent a room in this town and work here. I mean, you know, forget
it. Let's just for a moment examine the culture as best as we can. Mm-hmm. We have a culture that validates and exalts Las Vegas and glitz. Not that these things are even necessarily bad, all right? That's what we get. We're lucky that things aren't worse in many ways. But to me, one of the fundamental issues is that people don't want to know. Mm-hmm. They don't want to know that they're involved. They don't want to have any accountability or remorse. If you're involved in a thing called community, then you have accountability. You can't be perfect all the time.
Let me say something.
You have to exhibit remorse.
Let me say something about that.
Rather than have that self-searching soul endeavor, that self-analysis, we do things like, you know, have the cops.
Well, let me suggest something here.
Enforce law.
Yeah, there's a problem I've always suggested with merchants. I would like to see merchants and people with whom they have disputes on, you know, street people or whatever, get together rather than simply call somebody in who's with a badge and a gun. But, I mean, I think one of the reasons that people generally are so isolated and alienated, and again, I leap back to the 50s and 60s sort of sociologists and their analysis of this, is that they don't have a real sense, any sense of power that they can reach out and talk to other people, that they can even be heard. I mean, you know, you used to have mass organizations in the 30s, unions, where people could actually, and maybe that's what we need again, organizations where people could really express themselves. In the 60s, you had organizations where people came together and could be heard.
Express themselves for what? What did they want in the 30s?
Well, in the 30s, they wanted the right to be able to unionize, the right to be able to not have their farm taken away from them.
What they wanted was the ability to own a house and to not know anything. To live comfortably, Robert. Now, give me a couple minutes on this because this to me is key. This whole idea of rudeness, 2002 rudeness, mm-hmm. lack of community, is because what people want, generally speaking, is to be bought off. Here's a house. Here's a fairly nice neighborhood. There's Las Vegas. There's Disneyland. Drop out. Don't think. You're not involved. It doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, remember that a lot of people spend a lot of time doing a lot of work that they don't want to do. And so they feel they have a right to go somewhere and have a little peace, whether it's to have a cup of coffee or some sushi at Sushi Now, and then sit in the, you know, and not be disturbed by even the possibility of any kind of conflict.
If we had a peaceful culture internally, it would be revolutionary.
Well,
it would be so different from what we have now.
But remember,
what we have now is let's keep busy, and let's be abrasive, and let's push ourselves on others because that's some kind of a proof of power.
Well, I mean, certainly what you say has something to do with a macho culture, but I think that a lot of people.
Have you seen a shift? You're old enough, Robert. To am I correct on this? There's a shift that you can kind of isolate that hit a high note in the late 70s. An attempt to be respectful. including the trend towards smaller vehicles.
I don't know. I mean, I understand.
Smaller cars.
I know there
the trend
were...
Now, the trend now is towards SUVs and monster cars. Right. In fact, well, we're having to realign our parking lots. That's how significant this trend is towards...
Well, just
in your faces.
Just don't sleep in your SUV at night in Santa Cruz, is all I can tell you. But let me ask you while you're on the phone, Bob, have you heard anything more about rent control in surrounding cities like San Jose, Seaside? Of course, we talked to today with Mel Melson. But
I remain fascinated by the issue of rent control because because it makes people think. It's a good way to force a lot of issues to the surface. I remain, in some degree, willing to advocate the issue of rent control on a level that has a chance to be dialogued and can serve as an educational forum. So it's a good kind of a fulcrum issue. In my opinion, with the advent of some state legislation that has impeded what might be more full-blown examples of rent control from providing for their communities, like vacancy control, I doubt seriously that Santa Monica, Berkeley, or San Francisco are considering dismantling their rent control. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very, in my opinion, cowardly and absurd argument. It's like saying that we simply can't take on civil rights because black people can't drink at water fountains. It's not at a level where we can take it seriously.
Or homeless people are being denied service in restaurants in Santa Monica or Venice Beach. That's what we were talking about earlier on today's show. What's happening in Santa Clara County? Anything new on rent control?
Not that I know of. I mean, I'm sure it would be fairly public as soon as something happens. There are statewide attempts at tenants' rights from the broader perspective. Quite often, this once again comes back to people wanting to know, Robert, the plight of a tenant. If you don't own property, the reality of the community that would simply not exist were it not for the $8 or $10 an hour worker, who can never afford to own property. And so we say rent control is quite rational. You know, given the Enron debacle, how many of us would say that we should deregulate, should continue to deregulate utilities? What happens is that things get outlandishly out of hand.
Any comments?
Any regard for the respect for the human context.
Any comments on the supervisorial race coming up in the 3rd District there, Bob? Marty Wormhout, Freeman Ackles.
For several reasons that I will vote for Marty Wormhout.
You silly boy.
I have seen Marty Wormhout on at least a couple of instances exhibit very informed and courageous principle. I believe that more than most politicians that I've seen, she's at least willing to explore an issue. She certainly has her opinion on issues, and more power to her. I'm voting for Wormhout. I happen to disagree with her, by the way, on Highway 1. I think Highway 1 should be widened.
You also disagree with her.
And by the way, Robert, I think Santa Cruz should have a convention center.
You also disagree with her around rent control and, I think, and around the sleeping ban as well.
I'm not all that convinced that Marty Wormhout is against rent control.
She certainly hasn't done anything for it.
What one could say is that she's not a proponent of it.
Right.
All right.
Well, that's just as bad.
I would not go so far as to say that Marty Wormhout.
If you're in power and you don't speak up for it, then as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter if you're against it. You're doing the same thing. You're not advocating for it. People are hurting, and you keeping your mouth shut. That's enough for me to kick her butt out.
I don't want to put words into Marty Wormhout's mouth, and I would advocate voting for Marty Wormhout, by the way.
I know you do. I disagree.
But I think that it's the general style of people that get elected. They're not going to touch a hot potato until it's handed to them on a platter. And you can call that a lack of leadership.
I do, and so do you, Bob.
I claim and will continue to claim, but then you
have... So Marty Wormhout is not a leader on this issue. Let's be honest.
I'm not voting for either DA candidate.
Right, well, no, I don't want to hear you... Bob, I've heard you criticizing Crone and other people as a bunch of progressive sellouts, but Marty Wormhout is suddenly... It's okay for her not to have leadership on this issue? What's going on here?
I appreciate the chastisement. You asked me for what position...
Right, no, I appreciate your candor.
I am going to vote for Wormhout. I'm not voting for any DA candidate.
Okay.
All right.
Well, they're all a bunch of weenies on the drug war, that's for sure.
These are difficult calls. I mean, what do you do in the real world?
That's right.
With real people that are capable of becoming electable individuals.
Well, it's not the
market. I would give some slack to warm up. But in general, Robert, these issues, which are quite sincere, and rent control is classic along that line, as is hemp, by the way.
Yep.
You know, Sam Farr's comments on hemp publicly was that we don't need it and it should be kept illegal. If you've read up on the hemp situation.
No, I'm glad you bring it up, though.
It would have been very interesting to have seen the DEA enforce this anti-hemp food law. That would have been very interesting. You talk about a police state.
Well, that's coming up, isn't it? I mean,
they backed off at the last minute because of the absurdity of it.
Well, I heard that they postponed
the utter absurdity of it.
Wait a minute, Bob. I heard that they postponed it, but they haven't come. They come to a final decision. It's not going to be enforced.
I agree with you. It's been tabled. All right.
It's been postponed.
But during that tabling, now that it's been tabled, there are states that are elevating hemp legislation again, and these things, for what it's worth, do take time. It takes time for the enough states to exhibit some courage that the country as a whole can be shown that the position held by the authorities is not necessarily correct.
Well, that's another reason, for example, I don't favor Wormhout. She has surrendered to Mark Tracy in not standing up for standards for like the Sonoma standards that would allow people to grow a certain amount of hemp as providers. Instead,
you're looking for, maybe what I'm looking for too, Robert, is someone that is electable and that is truly progressive and is not afraid to take on the righteous issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so hemp, like rent control, as long as these issues are suppressed mm-hmm. and kept off the table, then they're hot potatoes and we can evade them. But quite honestly, in a market like Santa Cruz, if you don't own property, it is likely that you never will. Wages are never going to catch up to the reality where people are going to all own property here in Santa Cruz, mm-hmm. no matter how many houses are built.
Well, I got to roll.
So rent control becomes very, very rational.
It does, and it is. Give you 30 seconds, and then we're going to get out of here. Finish
cowardice up. Does not require a formal conspiracy to be effective. Thanks a lot, Robert.
Hey, thank you, Bob.
Thank you much.
Bye-bye. And that was activist Bob LaMonica, who puts together, along with others, the Hemp Festival every year and has been working on rent control at different times. Sometimes it seems almost alone. Lines are open at 427-3772, 427-FRSC. I was reading an article from High Times on No Compassion, Another Club Bites the Dust, Elmira, New York. One of New York City's cannabis compassion clubs was closed some months ago, and police raided the home of 65-year-old Sherry Wilkie in upstate Elmira on December 5th and confiscated 2 pounds of medical marijuana. Wilkie, who suffers from severe arthritis and has a pacemaker, was arraigned on December 13th and charged with felony possession of marijuana in the second degree. Simultaneously, she was ordered not to leave her federally subsidized housing because of her admitted use of marijuana on the premises. Wilkie opened the Elmira Medical Marijuana Buyers Club in 1998 and had more than a dozen regular patients who suffered from a variety of serious ailments, including cancer, clinical depression, and serious injuries. These people needed this medicine, she told Homeless Times, or High Times, I should say. I was stuck on the homeless here. High Times just prior to her arraignment, and now they can't get it. How will they afford to get it on the streets now that they don't have this club? While it is unlikely that Wilkie will be forced to do jail time, it is likely that the prosecutor will ask that she be put on probation that would include regular urine testing, an idea she is having a difficult time coping with. The use of this wonderful plant has kept me out of a wheelchair and pretty well pain-free for a number of years, she says. Before I discovered medical marijuana, I was on the verge of suicide because I simply couldn't live any longer with constant 24-hour-a-day pain and the sleeplessness that went with it. If I have to go back to living like that, in that kind of pain, I would rather die, and that is the position the government is going to try to put me in. Along with cannabis, police seized just over an ounce of hashish, club funds, and Wilkie's Social Security money for the month. Police claim that complaints about the marijuana smell from neighbors prompted them to send an undercover agent who was not ill to the club seeking medicine. I don't know if it's true that I gave some medicine to an undercover, says Wilkie, but for heaven's sake, I truly believe that everyone who came to me was ill and needed this. That's by Peter Gorman, No Compassion, Another Club Bites the Dust, at the April 2002 issue of High Times. And then we have this story. New York City, before we do, let's get some thing from Santa Cruz. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert, this is Ed.
Hey, Ed.
Hey, why don't you have, Bob LaMonica on for, at least an hour on one of your programs? And you guys can just argue and argue. I love it.
You do, do you?
Yeah.
Well, Bob and I do a lot of jousting about. He often has some interesting new things to say, and I try to dredge up a few new arguments. How's life from... Go ahead.
Two quality minds. I appreciate it. I'd just love to just, you know, be like an observer and listen to that for like an hour or two, preferably, but...
Well, Bob was working on a rent control forum at one time, although I think we don't have the funding to do it the way it needs to be done. We were going to try to really get a bunch of people together to discuss those issues in a really high-quality way, but that may yet come about. You never can tell.
Yeah, by hearing him, he mentioned the late 70s, and I recall, I've looked back as to what the hell happened, why this vile change, and I recall the waving that ugly, vile flag out in the Boston Harbor, 1776 to 1976 Bicentennial Celebration. And then it was 80, Reagan, but actually was actually Bush running the country, but Reagan is the puppet front man. Mm-hmm. And it just got, now we've got another Bush, right? It's just gotten worse and worse.
Well, yeah, I mean, it certainly, at the top, it's gotten, you know, it's gotten worse or stayed just as bad. It's true. I mean, although... You know, the masses of people at the bottom continue to, you know, we continue to try to live. That's what happens.
A therapist told me one time, she said that everybody had gotten pretty much co-opted.